the new week, we're going to continue our discussion of the visual system. So it'll be a nice bridge from last time to this time. Before I start, any administrative questions that we should, procedural things we should take care of? Thank you for very orderly handing in of your new apps. I think that worked a lot better this time. I think it's probably thanks to the DAs too. So we're looking at anatomy and physiology of the visual system. Recall that this is an endless topic. We could talk for months about details here. So we've picked out things that are functionally important. To bridge from last time, I want to show you where we are. Having left the retina, we are heading into the cortex, and these electrical signals from the retina cross at a place called the optic chiasm. It's not a particularly important thing to know unless you're doing research in that area. But they head through the lateral geniculate nucleus, which is kind of a relay station. We're not completely sure what it does, but we'll tell you something about it in a minute. And where we're really heading is visual cortex. Today is mostly about cortical functions of vision. So now a very different view, your brain. The occipital lobe, which is your visual cortex, kind of on the back. You can pat yourself on the back of the head and you're there. If you find that that causes strange visual hallucinations, I don't know the reason. The frontal lobe is up here, and when we said early in the course that about 40% of your brain, of your cortex, is concerned with visual information processing, what that should tell you is that this little patch back here isn't going to be the full amount. In fact, it's going to start a succession of processing areas that go forward, both in the parietal lobe up here toward the top, and the parietal, and the temporal lobe. It's going to come down here, it's actually labeled, down here, and then ultimately some visual processing involves even the frontal lobe. Now, that first level in the visual cortex, we're going to call V1. We're going to call it that because everyone else does. And this is the first cortical level of vision, and there's some very interesting functional things to talk about. First of all, I want you to know that most of what we know about V1 comes from a technique for which two investigators, Hubel and Wiesel, won a Nobel Prize. How many have heard that before? Hubel and Wiesel? Okay. Well, somehow you got through intro psych without hearing that, but sorry. The technique they used is to take tiny electrodes, what are called microelectrodes, put them into the brain of a cat or a monkey typically, and the electrode is so small you can get it into a single cell. Since you're pretty sure you're in the visual part of the brain, you now go around to the front and you show patterns on the eye of the cat or the monkey, and what you're interested in is what makes this cell fire. And firing means a discharge, an electrical discharge, but these cells have a base rate of firing, so what we really mean is they start firing very frequently. There's going to be many spikes that are picked up in these recordings in a short time. That's how we know all this, and I want to tell you a little bit about that before I just tell you magically that we know these things. One thing we know about the visual cortex is we have what's called a retinotopic map. This means a map that preserves adjacencies on your eye. So on the retina, if parts of the world are imaged next to each other, then in the cortex, that processing will also be next to each other. And this is, of course, leading back to that important fact about preserving information by projecting information from the world onto the eye. I'm going to take time out for a second. I haven't wanted to do this, so I've counted to about 15, the number of instances. And I'm going to repeat a course rule. I would like you not to get up and leave during class or come in during class, and especially not in the front area of the class. If you feel you have to leave during the class due to an emergency, if you have any idea that's going to happen before class, sit in the back, exit in the back. If you do have an emergency, exit in the back, as that gentleman just did. But I've let it go about 15 or 20 times, and I suspect that's just people who weren't here the first day. The reason is, I draw a blank. When somebody starts moving around the classroom while lecture's going on, I forget where I am and can't do this thing. And I promise, for my part, I will never get up and leave during lecture. Okay, back to the visual cortex. Time out over. Adjacent things are adjacent. However, they're not the same size on the cortex as they are on the eye. In particular, this is described as something called cortical magnification factor. And there's a kind of cool picture we have that looks like this. And I hated this graphic. I thought this was about the worst graphic in the world until I spent some time staring at it. So I want you to do that too. The one in your book is modified from this, but it's pretty much the same. One thing you should realize is that these little protrusions aren't little bits of cortex, but they're kind of shading. This is actually a slice. What you have here is a slice going back of your cortex. So it's kind of like a tabletop. And we can look at your eyes and the... I'm sorry, your eyes are up here. So your eyes are up here. And then the fibers pass to the two hemispheres of the brain. But the detail you'll start to notice if you study this figure in your book is there's some numbers here. So where in the visual field is it? 5 is the midline. So 6 is to one side and 4 is to the other. And then you can see that there are little numbers down here. And it will show you which parts of the visual field go to which hemisphere of the brain. And there's a few other cool things in there that I'll leave for you. But the one reason I'm showing you the graphic now is to show you this idea of cortical magnification. The things that are right near the center of vision, the things you're looking at, specifically on the fovea, are overrepresented in the cortex, which means they're blown up. There's many more cells that are concerned with the center of the field of view than with the periphery. So the eye that somebody's looking at is very large relative to, say, the hair. And if you got further out, the hand probably doesn't get much representation. It would be very, very small compared to the part that's represented here. So it's kind of eerie distortion of a face. By the way, something I noticed looking at this, because of the way the visual fields go to the brain, when you look at somebody's face, you're actually seeing half turn this way and the other half turn the opposite way, which is very spooky. So when you look at people, may never look the same to you now. Okay, by the way, the functional reason, what's a functional reason that the center of vision may have more cells that it drives in the brain than things out in the periphery? The acuity, the best visual detail that we get is in that fovea, and that means a lot more processing is devoted to it. Specifically, every ganglion cell in the fovea is picking up one receptor, and so that information about spatial separation of things is preserved all the way into the cortex. Out in the periphery, as we saw last time, there's a pooling. Many rods converge on one ganglion cell, so it's actually economical in a sense that you need fewer cells to capture the information. On the downside, you've lost quite a bit of spatial resolution. Okay. One of the reasons Hubel and Wiesel won the Nobel Prize is they gave us a beginning description of what the cells in V1 do. And this has been pursued in a really great chapter in science. We now have a very good idea what these cells do, and some idea, but not enough, of how that contributes to ordinary seeing of objects and events. There's a lot more to be done there. We have a pretty good idea what these cells do. The first thing I want to tell you is the biggest thing, that each cell in your cortex is looking at a rather small area on the retina. In other words, if you want to influence a cell in your visual cortex to activate, you have to find the place on the retina that it cares about. So each cell is local in the sense. It's looking at a small area. And when we define that area, we're defining what scientists call the receptive field of that cell. So the receptive field of a brain cell in the visual cortex is that area on the retina that will cause it to increase its firing or decrease its firing, any change from the base rate. These cells, the ones that Hubel and Wiesel found, the first type is called simple cells. And they are localized, as I said, and they care about orientation. I'll show you that a little bit more. But oriented contrast, such as an edge of an object. Also, they vary by spatial frequency. Now, spatial frequency is a complicated concept. We'll see it a little bit later. But for now, think of it as size. So if you think of dark to light changes that are oriented, your visual system is looking for these on a very small scale and at a very big scale. And we use that information for different things. There's a second kind of cell that's very much like a simple cell, but Thiebaud and Wiesel gave it another name, complex cell. And what these cells do is, again, they're somewhat local. They care about orientation. They vary by spatial frequency. But they are able to respond even if the stimulus is moved a little bit. If it doesn't have to be in a precise position. And in fact, they like motion. So they respond quite a bit to moving stimuli. The simple cells are kind of fixed in location. The complex cells are sensitive over a bigger area and kind of like motion. And finally, there are what are called end-stop cells, which you'll only understand when I show you a picture. But they're kind of looking for corners or the ends of objects. Okay, so here again is what I said, but I wanted to say out front. We find the stimulus that a cell responds to by displaying stimuli on the eye. Your book says something just fascinating about Hubel and Wiesel finding this out. Do you know why Hubel and Wiesel were able to find out that oriented edges made these cells fire in the cortex? Anybody see that yet? Oh, I'll tell you. I'll take credit for it by telling you the story. So Hubel and Wiesel did their training with a guy named Kufler, who was famous for single-cell recording from ganglion cells of the retina. And it turned out that ganglion cells of the retina, I'm going to go, I guess it's on the next slide. Okay. Ganglion cells on the retina have this kind of organization. If you show them a spot of light surrounded by darkness, they really like that. So for any given cell, you have to find the right part of the retina. But that cell will be triggered by this pattern. Now, there are also the reverse kind. Things that like a dark spot surrounded by light. So these are both big activations. If it's an on-center cell, you activate it this way. If it's an off-center cell, you activate it this way. And it says here, cell fires rapidly, and cell fires rapidly here. But if you just show a dark field that covers the center and the surround, you get nothing. If you show a light field that covers the center and surround, you get very little. Does that make sense? This is what you find in your retina for the nerve cells that collect information. And you find this at the lateral geniculate nucleus. So here's a great statement for you to hang your hat on. One of the few absolute certainties in vision. There's no sensitivity to orientation before the visual cortex. The lateral geniculate nucleus and the retina, they're looking for spots, essentially. Now, the part I wanted to say... Oh, the story I want to tell you about Hubel and Wiesel is they worked for a guy named Kufler. And Kufler taught them how to do this thing with the retina and the cells and look for spots. And so what Hubel and Wiesel were going to do was do the same thing in the visual cortex. Any idea what happened when they showed these spots in the visual cortex? Do the cells in visual, the neurons in visual cortex like this? They're very apathetic. Almost like a Thursday afternoon class, you know, which we don't have, so we don't have to worry about that. But they're very apathetic for that. However, Hubel and Wiesel were putting the slide, they had a slide where they put the dark surround and the light spot, and they had to insert the slide. And the monkey is watching this process one day, and suddenly the cell they're recording from goes crazy. What happened? The oriented edge, the edge of the slide, triggered the cell. So this is a little bit of serendipity. Serendipity is a term I will not define in this course, because it's not a perception. Okay, so let's look at these simple cells. They respond to bars of specific orientations. These diagrams always attempt to help you, but always end up confusing you, so I will try to lead you through. The X's here are going to be an excitatory area, meaning the cell likes it when there's light anywhere in here. The triangles are an inhibitory area, meaning this particular cell that we're considering right now, if you put light out here, it tends to reduce its activation. This cell likes a vertical, that's why it's oriented this way. So this receptive field is looking for essentially a vertical bar of light. When you show it a vertical bar of light, you get many spikes in an interval of time. This is, by the way, many times a second that these neurons will fire. When the stimulus goes on, you start getting spikes. When it goes off, it stops. If you change the orientation a little bit, does the cell stop firing completely? No, it still responds a little bit. And by the way, this is what we call coarse coding in your system. The cells that like verticals are going to respond at 15 degrees. So you are able to tell the difference in orientation. Anybody want to guess in degrees? What is your threshold for telling two different orientations?
Three.
It's like one or two. That's a great guess. So if you only have cells, if you have cells that looking for verticals still respond a little bit to 15 degrees, something has to happen further on to collect and compare different responses of different cells. And indeed, we do that. This is called coarse coding. But that's not part of today's lecture. That was just for fun. Now, if the video goes off, no, that didn't happen to human beetles. So if you show horizontal, however, you get nothing from these cells. So that's an example of what these cells are like. The complex cells, very similar in the orientation specificity, but they are more active when the stimulus is moving. And some of these cells respond to motion in any direction, whereas some are specific. So here's an example. Again, spikes are going to be the currency here. When you get a lot of them, that's good. This cell doesn't respond much to a horizontal moving up and down. The cell doesn't like at all this oblique movement, but if the cell's oriented this way and moves, you get quite a few spikes. This one likes movement in the up into the right direction, and when it goes the other way, it's quiet. So you get a bunch of spikes every time it moves up into the right. Okay, end stop cells. Human beetles found fewer of these, but it looks like these cells respond best for a corner, something like this. The dotted lines are defining what the investigator has already figured out is essentially the receptive field of this cell. The cell is going to like it if you get light in one of these boxes and dark in the other. So here is an object or a projection of light that just encroaches a little bit on the field. You get only a couple of spikes. And it has a little bit of movement sensitivity. So it can get this pattern kind of coming or going. Now here's a little bit more of encroachment. You get more spikes. Here you get more spikes. But here, what's happened? You've actually put some of the light into the inhibitory field. This field, in other words, is looking for something that ends right here. So when the light spills over, it kind of quiets it down. And when the light is equally present in both boxes, you get very little. Now, Hubel and Wiesel thought that this is going to be the basics of form perception. Edges, corners of objects, and then 30 years more research made the story a little more complicated. But we still believe in some way that these cells feed into all of our pattern and object perception. And as for the complications, we'll see that in a bit. There's another fact you should know about V1. So besides what a single cell cares about, there's an overall organization. Now you already know that a section of V1 will care about a section of the retina. But there are also interesting kinds of columns, specifically three kinds: location columns, orientation columns, and what we're going to call ocular dominance columns. Any idea what ocular dominance is? So cells in V1 typically are driven much more by one eye or the other. Later on, you'll see cells in later areas, such as V2, they're driven by both. This is just an overall schematic. There's something that you might call a hypercolumn, which is going to include location columns, left and right eye cells, which will be next to each other, and then orientation subcolumns. So you don't yet know exactly what I'm talking about when I say location column, and I'm aware of that, so let's look at one of them. If you're looking at the surface of cortex, and this little curve represents the surface of the cortex, if you were to put an electrode down to different depths, 1, 2, 3, 4, and this is put in perpendicular to the surface, what you will find is the areas on the retina that make it fire, the receptive fields, are going to be in closely overlapping locations. So it looks like a bunch of cells in a column here care about the same part of the visual field. Of course, you have no direct access to the visual field. You have only the part of the retina that's receiving information. So when we say, we might say the cortex cares about locations on the retina, but we're really not trying to see our retina. We're trying to see the world outside. So this is just as well described as parts of the visual field that the cortex is encoding. Locations live together. You can also come in this other way, and this isn't exactly perpendicular. And because it's not exactly perpendicular, you see you'll get nearby locations, but not exactly the same. The second kind of column is this orientation column, which is you go, again, perpendicular, and a whole bunch of cells that you find all like horizontal edges. They like contrast, an area of dark next to an area of light that all have horizontal orientations. If you go somewhere else, you might find vertical orientations. And hypercolumns try to pull this all together. I just told you that if you go perpendicular, you get the same location, and if you go perpendicular, you get the same orientation. And you may be asking, because you're following every word, what about different orientations in that same location? And the answer is they're nearby. So it looks kind of like this. This whole gigantic thing is a hypercolumn. It's concerned with the same location, roughly. But you can find, going in a column, different orientations in that location. And also, you can find cells that are driven mostly by the left eye inputs and the right eye inputs, and these are going to be next to each other. So this is a very densely packed, beautifully arranged organization of your cortex to encode information coming in from outside. All right, now, take a deep breath. Let's clarify a term I've used already, spatial frequency. Your book is very good on this, and one of the authors of your book, Dennis Levy, is a real expert in this. So I better tell you what it is. When we say a V1 cell is tuned to spatial frequency, the simplest thing that you could remember, and the only thing I really want you to remember from this course, is that means scale. So you can think of, if I had a picture, you can think of bars of a certain thickness where there's black, white, or you can think of much thinner bars. These two are going to differ in their spatial frequency. All this really means is if you look at an area on your retina, the number of dark and light transitions in that area is the frequency. You've got something that's changing spatially, in particular the brightness from light to dark. And then down here, does this have a lower or a higher spatial frequency than the one above? So I heard "er" at the end, which is the same ending for higher and lower. What's the first part? Higher or lower? Higher, great. Okay. So that's what we mean by spatial frequency. Now there's actually a reason, quite a tedious one, but I'm going to tell you. What I'm going to tell you is really interesting intellectually. A little confusing for where you are now in this course, and not something we're going to hit you over the head with a lot on a test. But it is the case that when Hubel and Wiesel found oriented contrast detectors, they thought these were bar detectors or edge detectors. But it turns out that these cells, maybe I have a nice diagram further up. Is that okay? Right here. It turns out that if you go back to one little V1 cell, go back with your microelectrode, make friends with this cell, You're going to make friends with the cell so that it's going to tell you its deepest secrets. Whereas Human Weasel showed a bar of light flanked by a bar of darkness with a very crisp edge in between. It turns out that is not the favorite stimulus for these cells. By the way, it's a great question. When you're shining a stimulus on the eye, recording from a cell, and asking, what is the cell looking for? And you get a big response. Do you know for sure that that's what the cell is looking for? There might be something out there that would give an even bigger response, right? So this kind of work always has some freedom of interpretation at the end. And that's a great scientific lesson, because Hubel and Wiesel thought they were seeing bar detectors. But later work, very sophisticated, brought in concepts from signal processing. It turns out that you can encode complex waveforms in terms of sine waves. And it turns out the very best stimulus for a V1 cell is a sinusoidal transition from dark to light to dark. You all know what a sine wave is? It's that. This thing up in the upper left. And so the spatial frequency that we use to characterize your cells, this graph is on the y-axis, it would be brighter, darker. Brighter is higher. So it's across space on the x-axis, it gets brighter, darker, brighter, darker. So the cells in your visual cortex are looking for that. However, you do not have one cell that looks across the whole field. Otherwise, the receptive fields wouldn't be local. And I told you they were local, and I don't lie. So you have what we call a windowed sinusoid. Now, how many of you this time in the afternoon are looking for a nice dose of higher mathematics? Raise your hand. Okay, so that's none of you. But in case you are interested, I will tell you that the way you get this is that sine function that you studied in trigonometry multiplied by a Gaussian window. That Gaussian window, you know what a two-dimensional Gaussian looks like. It's a normal distribution, right? If you rotate that thing around its center, you get a circle, essentially, with a hump in the middle. And what that's what we use for this two-dimensional display. What that means is we're going to show through the sine wave that's here. We're going to show it through very clearly in the center where the Gaussian is high. This is a circular Gaussian. It looks kind of like a hat. Okay. And then out to the periphery, we're going to show less and less of that sine wave that's lurking back there. And then if you get far enough away, it's all gone. And the background is just medium gray. Okay, you don't have to understand all that, but I want to tell you what windowed sinusoid meant. Here's what you do have to remember. The cells in your visual cortex care about contrast in particular orientations on particular scales. So you've got big ones like this, and then down here we've got some little ones. And these can be described as spatial frequency detectors. Now, I can also get you to think creatively about this. If I said that Hubel and Wiesel were not right, that each stimulus is looking for a single bar of light, but instead people think they're looking for sinusoids, how would you ever get that in an experiment? What could you do to test that? Any ideas?
Could you have instead of a high contrast with light and dark, just have a slighter contrast, so for example a light of high intensity and a light of low intensity with a sinusoid in the middle?
So one thing you could do, I'm freely translating what you said, but I think you're on the right track. One thing you could do is see if an abrupt edge is better than a gradual edge. And the other is, if you started out as Hubel and Wiesel did with one bright bar and flanked by a dark bar, or even one bright bar flanked by a dark bar, you can add some other lobes, some other beyond the dark, another little light one. And in fact, the cell does fire better if you start to add more of the sine wave. But it tapers off very, very gradually, as it does, as expressed by this Gaussian function.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons. And the other, there's other theoretical reasons, but unfortunately the simple story that V1 finds edges is not yet a complete story. It's not quite as simple as Hugo and Wiesel had hoped. And likewise, the idea that V1 and stop cells find the corners of objects, they probably play a role, but we don't know what the computation looks like. Okay, it's a good time to say something about spatial frequency and contrast, because this will help us later. Yes?
The more black and white you have, the more sideways you have?
Yeah, it's more cycles. So one thing that's going to differ between a bar detector and a sine wave detector is a bar detector is only going to be looking for one bar. It turns out if you have more cycles of this bright, dark, bright, that activates the cell more.
The other thing is there any big difference between visual processing with the male and the female? Like, is it true that you're getting somewhere that females have 40% better peripheral vision?
You know, I've never heard that. The only visual difference that I know of for certain is there are a few, and this isn't really an overall gender difference. When we get color vision, we're going to find we have three cone mechanisms, three underlying photopigments that absorb differently. There are a few women walking around with four. So men, when they tell you your shirt does not match your pants, they might be right. It's going to get worse. There's more color blindness among males, too. Okay, so the spatial frequency, here's your quick quiz. These two patterns are different. Are they different in spatial frequency? No, they're the same. But they do have different contrast. One way we look at contrast is we take the difference of the maximum and minimum brightness, and we put that over the sum. And this is a very elegant formula for contrast because it puts everything on a scale of 0 to 1. Or maybe, yeah, if you, as long as you make sure L max is really L max. Otherwise, if you get it mixed up, you can get to minus 1. And you can go home and play with that and figure out why. But this is a formula for contrast. And the reason for telling you that is now that we have some idea of what your V1 cells are looking for, we have a very good way of characterizing your visual ability at a low level. So we call this the contrast sensitivity function. And what we're going to do here, I'm going to try to follow a good convention for you to emulate whenever you present graphs to people. In this graph, we have on the x-axis spatial frequency. And that spatial frequency is expressed as the number of cycles per 1 degree of visual angle. So remember that fovea is about 1 or 2 degrees, and your whole visual field, if you take a slice from your right hand, the limits of what you can see to the right, all the way to what you can see to the left, that's about 180 degrees. That's about half of a circle. It's actually a little bit more than that, by the way. What we're asking then is for a piece of the retina that's picking up 1 degree of the world, how many cycles of dark and light stripes there are. And that's what's indicated here. So 10 cycles per degree is a very fine stimulus with a lot of black and white transitions. And what we're plotting here is how sensitive you are to this. Sensitivity is the inverse of threshold. So the lower your threshold, the less contrast you're able to detect, I mean, the smaller differences you're able to detect, the higher your sensitivity. So high numbers are good. And all I want to show you in this graph is this dark line. Ignore this other part here. You can read about that in your book. But we actually have very good sensitivity from the low spatial frequency, where it's about one cycle per degree. That means in 1 degree of visual angle, one dark stripe, one light stripe. By the way, just for reference, I like to put real-world ideas with these numbers. If you hold your thumb out, you know, like an artist, and I'll ask you later in the course why artists would ever do this, but we're going to do it just because when you look at your thumbnail, at arm's length, that's 1 to 2 degrees. Okay, depending on the length of your arm, the size of your thumb, etc. But if you imagine in that space one dark bar and one light bar, or if you're sophisticated, a sinusoidal change from dark to light. then you know what this value is. You know what this value is down here, 1. Now imagine 10 black and white stripes stuffed into that same space, and you'd have 10, and 100 stripes. Do you imagine and you can actually paint these little stripes on your thumb. I just realized that. You can put 100 black and white stripes and hold it at arm's length. According to this graph, what would you see? Say again?
The stripes?
Gray.
Okay, the answer is gray. Because as this graph shows, as it's supposed to show, you have zero sensitivity at 100 cycles per degree. So there's a cutoff. The finest detail that you can see is somewhere in the range of 30 cycles per degree. Under very, very good conditions, it might even get up towards 60. And this is your visual acuity cutoff also. Okay. Any questions on that? Yes?
What do you mean by cycle per degree?
Well, it means one black stripe, one white stripe is one cycle. So just to go back to we went through some of this pretty quickly. And that question I will use to help recapture some of this. This has fewer cycles per degree than this. A degree is the amount of your visual field that's about as big as your thumbnail at arm's length. Okay, now here's a little bit of detail to fill in now that we have those basic concepts. One reason people were able to go to signal processing in other domains and get these concepts about spatial frequency is due to a mathematical theorem proven by the mathematician Fourier. And Fourier proved a theorem that we'll talk about again when we talk about hearing, because it's very applicable to sound. But in particular, what Fourier proved is abstract. It's about waves, not really sound or light or anything in particular. But it's that any complicated waveform can be matched by a summation of sine waves of different frequencies. Now, when you look at a visual image, if you look at a picture, when you look at a picture like this, you don't naturally think of it as being composed of black and white stripes. To apply this signal processing idea, your visual system essentially has to be doing a Fourier analysis of dark and light variation in every direction. So it's a two-dimensional Fourier analysis because you're dealing with a two-dimensional image. We'll come back to that picture in a minute. But if we think about a one-dimensional pattern like this, this pattern shows you the concept by simplifying and getting away from the two-dimensional image. In particular, this pattern has only one dimension of variation. If you go horizontally, you see it goes dark, light, but if you go vertically, it doesn't change at all. And this lets us see how the sine wave idea can apply. Specifically, we can give a description of that pattern that gives its profile of lightness and darkness across space. Now, the pattern we saw was actually an abrupt black and white pattern, so it wasn't quite this smooth transition. If Fourier told us that any complicated pattern can be made up of a set of sine waves, how can we ever get something that's absolutely black and absolutely white, absolutely black? Because this gradual thing doesn't quite cover it. And that's the example I'm going to give you. This is the most common way of demonstrating Fourier analysis. It's actually, we're going to go backwards and do Fourier synthesis. But before, while you look at this and start to guess what it's telling you, let me tell you a couple more facts. In Fourier's theorem, any complex waveform can be broken up into a sum of sinusoids, and you add those together to get the waveform. And also, he showed that there's a lowest frequency for any pattern, and then any other components are sine waves that are integer multiples of that. So you can have, if this is one cycle per degree, this is, say, 3, and this is 5, and this is 7, but you never need 1.5 times this lowest frequency, which is very, very amazing that this is true. Okay, now, again, this is the pattern we're trying to explain, because although it has quite a clear frequency, it doesn't have, it's not made of sine waves. And that's a nice case to show what Fourier was able to prove, which is this. If you have a sine wave that changes from dark to light with the same frequency as that black and white pattern, or we call that black and white pattern a square wave, because it's all black, then all white, all black. If you add to this one something like this, you get this. Notice that this now is looking a little bit more like a bar of light and then a bar of dark, but still a little lumpy. If we add this one in, it now starts to smooth out a little bit more. And so actually, the way you would get a square wave, which is a clear bar of black, clear bar of white, clear bar of black, is you actually have to add in this fundamental frequency, which we'll call F0, and then 3 times that, 5 times that, 7 times that, and also look at the amount of these, look at the amplitude, how high it is. It's a lot of this one, a little of this, even less of this, even less of this. So there's a rather beautiful mathematical decomposition where you're adding smaller and smaller waves, and to get a square wave out of sine waves, it's all of the odd components. So it's the third, 3 times the fundamental frequency, 5, 7, 9, and so forth. But you actually have to go all the way to infinity to get a perfect square here. Okay, now I realize that's a little bit confusing, but this is treated in your book, and the main idea I want you to get for the moment is what V1 cells are looking for turns out to be this kind of thing. And if they're going to help us see abrupt edges, like an abrupt transition from black to white, it's probably going to be by adding up cells that care about this, and then care about this and this. So cells of different spatial frequencies. So this has really all been an attempt to get you acquainted with that notion of spatial frequency. Okay, exhale. I know it's complicated. The summary of what I want you to have from this is that your V1 cells care about a location on the eye, orientation, and that's oriented what? Contrast. And they differ by the locations that they're sampling, by the orientations, and also spatial frequency. How finely or how coarsely they're looking for transitions from dark to light. Okay, your question? Okay. Now, by the way, there's a lot of fun things you can do with these. So, does anybody know who this is, by the way?
Carson Mars.
Okay, good. This one of you has completely forgotten that. Okay, this is kind of the normal image. If you actually remove the low frequency components here, which you can do with a program that does Fourier analysis, you can still see most of his face. If you take away the high spatial frequencies, now this is mislabeled, wait a minute. This is low. This is low, I mistake this, it's labeled fine. This is low spatial frequencies only, so the big transitions from dark to light are still present. But the fine-grained ones have been removed. You see how the fine details here, the sharp edges are kind of removed? This one has the low frequencies removed and has only the high spatial frequencies remaining. And there's a lot of fun things and good experiments you can do with filtering out some of the spatial frequencies. Okay, any questions on that so far? Yes?
What's the significance of this top graph?
What are we getting at? What's the significance of this top graph?
Yeah, how do we use it to understand vision?
Yeah, I was explaining spatial frequency.
So, the bottom graph doesn't explain it.
The reason that your system is looking for sinusoidal transitions from dark to light is it can use those to encode any image whatsoever. And the basis of this is a mathematical theorem proven by Fourier that any complex waveform can be broken down into a set of sinusoidal components. In this example, we took this square wave, which has dark, light with abrupt edges, and explained how you could make it out of sine waves. And this is a very standard textbook example to explain Fourier analysis. So for further information, you might want to consult the book. Other questions? Okay, so now you know what V1 is doing at the level of cells. And you probably have this question, what happens beyond V1? The rest of what we're going to tell you is mostly about areas, but only a little bit about cells, because all of this is still being explored. After V1, we think of two well-identified streams for visual processing, sometimes called the ventral stream and the dorsal streams. And this is how it goes. Remember that patch of occipital cortex back here? From here, the dorsal pathway goes up the top of your head and features the parietal lobe. The ventral goes underneath, featuring the temporal lobe. And we actually know something about what these areas do. This has evolved. The first people who theorized about all this didn't quite get it right, confused a lot of people. And this is still evolving, but generally, it's fair to say the ventral pathway has a lot to do with what you're looking at. The what system. Is it a face? Is it a dog? Is it a house? Shape and form are processed, at least for certain functions, in the ventral pathway. The other pathway seems very concerned with where something is, but that's not really a very good description. This is the one where we've been modifying continuously. I would say we get closer by saying it's a how path. I'm not completely content with this either. I would say we're going to get a better name for this. But the dorsal pathway gets you the structure of the environment in a precise way. So, not just the shape of an object, in that you can classify it, but how big it is, how it differs from other objects of similar shapes, and so forth. So we'll come back to that. But here's what the pathway looks like. V1, you know a lot about. V2 cells look a little bit like V1. There's more binocular interactions that we'll talk about later in the course. We're starting to think V4 processes color. But generally where we're headed is the object naming pathway, as you might say, cares about form and ends up in a temporal area called IT. And IT, as your book tells you, is inferotemporal cortex. Kind of the bottom, the underside of temporal cortex. The other pathway cares about structure and also movement, including an area MT, and goes to parietal. Now, I'm going to skip this because some of it won't make sense till later. But I do want to ask you a methodological question. How do we figure out that an area of the brain is doing a certain thing? I mean that seriously. Forget what's on the slide for a minute. What, how do you think you can find out that a certain area of your cortex has a certain function? Yes?
Try
FMRI. FMRI will work. I'm going to show you a nice example of that with faces at the end of today. But FMRI is not a magic wand. How would you do it with FMRI? Yeah, but you want to compare it to something. So you're going to say it's more active if we have a way of getting oxygen usage in parts of the brain. We find certain areas are more active when we're showing faces than when we're showing something else. Maybe scrambled faces or dogs. Even then, there's open interpretations about whether we've nailed it, whether we really have the right idea of the functions. Another way to do this is what's called double dissociation. Sometimes we find that people who have had an injury to a part of the cortex have lost a certain function, but they can still do something else. And then we find another class of patients who has had a different injury, and they've lost that something else, but can still do that first thing. This is called double dissociation. Okay, let's take the case of MT, which is motion. If you show moving displays and you vary their direction, you can find for a given cell in MT that it likes a certain motion direction. In area MT, you can find that cells that have a direction sensitivity, and if you get that one right, they like motion, it's 90% or more of the cells there. You can look at a comparison area, V4, and you find very few cells care anything about motion. So this is how we do that. Now, slipping back down to the so-called what pathway, in inferotemporal cortex, cells respond to patterns. And this has gotten very interesting. Sometimes the responses here are very specific. Some researchers were looking for orientation-sensitive neurons in the monkey IT, and somebody accidentally, they had kind of a brush. It was actually something that looked like a toilet brush. And they happened to move it into the monkey's visual field, and the cell went crazy. And it turned out this looked a little bit like a monkey's paw. At least that's what people think. But you might just as well say there's a toilet brush detector in the monkey cortex. Or maybe it's a monkey paw detector, but that illustrates the issue. When you find something that seems to activate, wow, that's sequential ballistic skating. Pretty amazing. Well, something going around. Let's just say we hope it's not an epidemic. Anyway, so here you can see some patterns that have been found to activate cells in MT. These are kind of funny. There's faces as well, which we'll talk about, and even some reports that very specific cells might activate cells in the retina. There's been a claim in recent years, not the retina, the cortex. There's been a claim in recent years in one study that the subject had a Jennifer Aniston cell. How many have heard that crazy thing? Okay, it might be true, but it's a little bit puzzling because a lot of things about the whole story of how we keep track of objects and events in the world isn't really going to make sense if you need one cell for one person, but it's out there. What I'll say is it's out there. So here are some experiments with fairly complex forms. If you find this form, now you have to tell me what in the evolution of primates has made this interesting. Is this a lollipop detector? Is it the ping pong paddle detector? Could be derived from the toilet brush thing. We don't really know. But this is, from the onset of the stimulus, how much activity. You get a burst and then a decreasing amount. If you just show the stem, you don't get much of anything. If you just show the circle, you get a weak response. And a shorter stem doesn't give you very much. And I think we've lost a little bit of the slide here. Let me see if I can... no idea. Screen us. Okay, there you go. All right, if you make the thing a little thicker at the stem, not much response. But a squarish thing with the same stem does pretty well. So I don't know. I mean, the point here is we're able to identify some cells that get activated quite a bit. And we don't know a lot about the big picture of how this all fits together in your perception. You've got something that likes this or this, and doesn't like this. And I'm sure there's some functional reason for that, but science hasn't yet figured it out. By the way, you make it a star, and you do pretty well here too. Okay, faces are an area that's been very well researched, and especially, as someone suggested a minute ago, with fMRI. fMRI is functional magnetic resonance imaging, discussed in your book a bit. We'll see it again. And here we're able to get the activation of areas under some conditions compared to others by measuring their use of oxygen. So it's a response that has to do with oxygen uptake. In the single cell recording work, which has not typically been done on humans, typically monkeys or cats, we do find cells that respond to faces or face-like pictures. And that has led people to speculate maybe we do have a special area for processing these. And we now believe there's a face area near a certain structure in the ventral pathway that's known as the fusiform gyrus. I'm not going to bother you more about that anatomy, but it has been affectionately referred to as the FFA, or fusiform face area. I myself think this is a little bit of a mixture. Face area is a functional term. Fusiform is a structural term. And so it's a funny kind of a name, but it's stuck. Now notice this last line here. There's some debate that the areas for processing any complex form that demands fine distinctions, like breeds of dogs, not just faces. I will add to that, it could also be an expertise area. Humans have a lot of experience processing faces. It's very important to us to tell one face from another. There are some studies that suggest that when you do this in another domain, when you get expertise through perceptual learning, you also may activate the same area. And there's some phenomena of behavioral processing, such as your inability to do this very well when the stimulus is put upside down, that also seems specific to both faces and areas where you have special expertise. So in one study, people who are very good at judging dog shows were tested, and in fact they show the same inversion effects, what happens when you turn the stimulus upside down, as people show for faces. So this is still a lively debate, and I'm going to try to illustrate that a little bit for you. But first, let's look at the basic data themselves. For humans, in fMRI studies of faces, you get some of the best results that we've gotten. Now, I particularly am concerned about many fMRI studies I see because people are making claims about 0.2% change in the use of blood oxygen in areas of the brain. And you should all know, as consumers of this kind of research, that the effects of these studies tend to be very small. There's always a baseline use of oxygen, and it's changes against that baseline, or changes or differences between two conditions that are used. But in the face area, I would say the data are much more robust than most. So they might get a few percent change in the use of blood oxygen rather than 0.2%. So that's one of the reasons this area stands out. Now, what about a method? Well, I'm going to tell you particularly about a study by Kanwisher, McDermott, and Chun, 1997. It's a very heavily cited study. And what you have to do in this kind of study is show the thing you're testing as a possible target for some brain area, and then contrast it with something you think that brain area should not care about. You typically do this in alternating intervals. Any of you know what an fMRI machine looks like, or an MRI machine? Okay, so you know it's a kind of a cavernous, tubular kind of thing. You get pushed into it. Your head is in this huge magnetic field. Now, just to help keep some things straight, what's the difference between MRI and fMRI? Okay, it's functional. What does that mean?
It shows actual blood flow in real time, as opposed to just like...
Right. It shows something that's changing in real time while you're doing something. Whereas structural MRI is a very important medical tool, which shows a lot of the anatomy and whether there's something unusual, for example, in your brain or, as you know, in your knee, depending on what you're looking for and where. Okay. So in this study with Kamischer, McDermott, and Chun, they did several things. One of the things I really like about this work is they didn't just use one control stimulus. One control stimulus they did use was to show faces in certain intervals. So you'd have 2 seconds of faces. I don't know if that's the right interval. One of the problems in fMRI is the temporal resolution isn't very good. So let's say 5 seconds of faces, just to make sure we get enough. And you can look at the article to see what it really is. 5 seconds of faces, pause, 5 seconds of scramble faces. We take the same images, we divide them up into regions, and we scramble those regions. So in terms of local responses from things like detectors in V1, we have lots of similar patterns. By the way, when you show faces, even if you're interested in area IT or a part of that area, would you expect V1 to respond? Yes or no? Yes, how about scramble faces? Yes. V1, that first visual area, is a gateway to all the pattern processing we do. So you do get those responses, but in this experiment, what would you expect? You would expect no difference in conditions between the faces and the scramble faces. So one of the things they do is face and scramble face. And down here in the data, that's here. An intact face is here. A scrambled face is here. And these are all two-tone images. I'm not sure why they did that. Two-tone images aren't real revealing. Grayscale images have a lot more information. But whatever, that's what they did. Now, as I said, one thing to like about the study is they used a couple of control groups. They also used ordinary objects and faces. So you have an interval of a face, and then an interval of object, interval of face, and so forth. And then they also did faces in houses, for whatever reason. Okay, what are we looking at in the data? We're looking at the percentage of increase in the blood oxygen use. Looking at the percentage of increase in the blood oxygen use. And we find the faces increased it by 1.9%. By the way, in most of the studies that any of you will ever do, if you get a 1.9% increase in something, that will be considered small. But there are whole armies of statisticians who are trying to make sense of small effects in brain imaging because the stakes are high. And I would tell you that 1.9% is a huge effect in this literature. It's a way big effect. On the other hand, it's not the case that objects did not activate this face area at all. You got a 0.7% increase in activation when you showed objects. And by the way, considering that there's a whole lot of fMRI studies out there where you only get a 0.4% increase in the good condition, this is a big response. So I wonder if anybody's puzzled over that. You know, well, does this mean it's a face, big face, little object detector area, or are we to discount this but then just forget that when we see the next presentation where we only have a 0.4% increase for something that's supposed to be encoded in some area? Anyway, any idea what this ratio column is? This is a ratio made from this activation over this activation. So the preference for faces, we're going to say, comes from the fact that this response is 2.8 times as big as this one. Conveniently, don't worry about how big the 0.7 is. It's certainly not as big as the 1.9. Intact and scrambled faces, about the same as with objects. And faces and houses. It really likes houses less than it likes scrambled faces, and it likes houses less than objects. So the ratio here is the biggest. 6.6 times the response to houses was shown to intact faces. Okay, so this should give you some little flavor of how these studies are done. Alright, pause. We're not finished. This is a great time, though, to reflect on what these studies get you and what they don't, especially in terms of the separate levels that we know we need to consider in understanding perception. I don't know why that slide is there. So let's make a few observations. First of all, these are relatively new techniques, and as you know, they generate a lot of excitement. One of the things you get here is you can put fMRI pictures as color pictures, and you put them in the newspaper. So a lot of people reading these, I'm really worried that they think parts of your brain inside are blue and green and yellow. Those are really just color codings showing how much the areas were activated. But it makes for great, you know, great pictures. The excitement is, I think, really justified in answering certain kinds of questions. Specifically, if you want to get some idea of what kinds of processing are going on in what locations in the brain, this looks like a very good technique. fMRI has a very good spatial resolution. In terms of understanding processing, it tends to integrate information over about 2 seconds, so it's really not very good at temporal resolution, resolution time. But in any case, for finding where faces might be processed, it's a pretty plausible technique, and the face findings are robust, at least compared to other fMRI findings. But this is the way I want to make sure we also consider a couple of other observations. First, any activation technique leaves a question of what's really the best stimulus. So if faces are things we have the most expertise with, they might be better than scrambled faces, and they might be better than other objects, and they might be better than houses. So you might want to test here experts in judging dog shows, or experts in stamp collecting, or something like that. Stamps that don't have faces, I guess. Okay, so finally I want to ask you this. The kind of work here can really be helpful in underscoring a lesson we learned last week, which is, as Mar said, there's three levels we need to understand perception. How about this kind of work? What level would you place this kind of work on face perception? So this is at the biological level. It's where in the brain something's located. If you had a computer that did face processing, would these studies tell you anything about where in the computer it's located? No. Okay, now how about this? Is this the only question you have? What if we were interested in asking, what information do humans use to tell one person's face from another? This study doesn't address that at all. And how about a question of, how would you program a computer connected to a video camera to recognize faces? Does this study of the fMR, of the fusiform face areas, tell us anything about that? Nothing. No. So those are left to be added to this, but it's a good study at one level. But I know people are packing to go. But any questions about anything we've covered today? Pretty complicated stuff. All right, I'm glad it's that clear. Next time.